to find it. You're fascinated by it, and then you read a couple of pages and you put it down and forgot it.
Yeah, see, but I want to read it.
The problem is it ain't no Spellbinder, you know? It's just kind of boring.
Well, now you need an editor.
Yeah, but, well, actually, yeah, it's, well, Eleanor's told me that too. See, like, my wife. Once I got almost done with that, I realized I really wasn't getting at what I was trying to get at. So then I wrote the war novel. I wrote Wham! Is my war novel. Mm-hmm. So I wrote that. And then I wrote this thing. And wrote a bunch more stuff. Did a lot of writing.
Yeah, I want to read it.
But that, the memoir is boring. I was still kind of like halfway in that political science mode, you know, where you write boringly.
Yeah, but you know, as an analytical document, you know, by someone who's both trained and experienced in what you're writing about, there's a big thing now. I mean, I'll give you an example. One of the best books out of Vietnam. Actually, two of them. One was a study of Hania Province, Dynamics of Defeat, and there's another book now called something like the Mekong Delta. You know, 1934-1935. You know, this kind of, you know, it. In-depth studies of particular areas and particular experiences, and the mosaic of them, you figure out what was going on.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with it. It doesn't have to be entertaining. I mean, I know several publishers that might be interested. Well, I'll take a look at it.
Good. Yeah, I appreciate that, because I got tired of getting reject slips on it. It was almost published a few times, but not quite. Penguin, they almost bought that one, but then they bought this outline I had for this one. Mm-hmm. And I went ahead and wrote that one. So that was, and then I just got tired of being ecology, or I got tired of Vietnam, you know, I just got my...
Your novel about Vietnam?
Oh, yeah.
Was that based on true events? Was that totally based on true events?
Well, in an emotional and psychological, cultural way, it's truer than my memoir. But it's just wild fantasy. But it has that kind of truth that
but
I couldn't get.
But it's a thing that could happen. It's not anything impossible.
No.
It's not like,
it couldn't happen. It's very...
Well, let's put it this way. Tim O'Brien said that there are two kinds of truth.
Yeah.
Since there's truth, and then there's story truth. And sometimes the story truth is more authentic in conveying the experience than actually saying what happened.
Yeah.
I'll give you a small example. In Apocalypse Now, this movie, very surreal movie, there's a scene in which soldiers have been worked to a fever pitch by dancing Playboy bunnies brought all over to Vietnam to entertain them. And they end up storming the stage, and the girls have to be taken away for their safety on a helicopter. Okay?
Yeah,
and
this is the
point. Is it's not like anything ever happened.
This is a good what?
But the director is talking about all the sexual energy and frustration and madness of Vietnam, and how ridiculous it was to put like a sex show in the middle of it, and yet it was all out of the reach of the soldiers. So that never happened, but it
was like they felt.
Yes, or it's something that everybody wishes afterwards did happen, that kind of thing. So it's not. It's not accurate in terms of what happened, but it does convey some of the emotion. Yeah, but it conveys the emotion.
Yeah.
And sometimes he goes overboard in that film, where he's conveying emotions that just were just, you know, they're truer about what Americans felt about the war than was actually what the people who were there felt. But in other cases, that's not so true, so it's pretty...
Yeah, I'm interested in reading your novel, too. I mean,
it's a lot more fun. That's what...
Then I probably want to read it, because it'll probably catch me easier.
Which novel, then?
Wham.
That's about Vietnam?
Yeah.
Where is it now?
I saw it a couple of three times when we were looking for the other one. But then
did you publish it?
No.
No? Okay.
It's in the trunk.
Well, you have to make a copy of it so I can send it to David Wilson. Oh, who's an incredible archivist of written stuff on Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite was, he saves everything written on Vietnam, and my favorite one is, I was a nurse captive of the Viet Cong. That they're like 20 pornographic novels of Vietnam. They're just like any other novel, but they've moved it into, you know, in other words, they're exploitation things. So they make use of Vietnam. There are even porno films of Vietnam.
Yeah.
And there's everything you can imagine. There's your husband back for your husband never get over Vietnam. Buy him this camouflage negligee and remind him of the good times. I swear, these are ads in newspapers, and not quite exactly like that, but they do sell camo negligees in Vietnam magazine. Harry Summers Vietnam magazine.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now we're getting down there. To the
the commercialization.
Sex City Chronicles.
Well, it's also the commercialization of...
Right.
It's in your trunk, is it, Dad?
I don't know where the hell it is. I remember seeing it a couple of times. Then it disappeared again. It's
well, then at least it's in our closet. I know it's down here.
Like the bodies in the Ganges, you know, they roll to the top and then down they go again.
I know that very well. A question. When, I slipped out of my mind. I'm in my head now. Were there many IVS or IVS teams with mutton yards?
Yeah, not a lot.
But Noosh was up there and banned me to it for quite a while. Richard Nishihara, aka Noosh.
Thank you.
Who else? I think the answer to that is no. I don't think there were.
Is it Shanti's?
Nope. Yeah, they were in the Highlands, and the Highlands was really so war-torn that usually they didn't post that many guys out.
What did you come to think of the IVS mission in your village? I mean, you know what, you were there. You know, it was an adrenaline rush of the highest order, and you were living a different reality. But as you stayed there that period of time, did you begin to realize, think back about what you were supposed to be doing and what it meant or what it was worth?
Well, now, in my case, up to the present second, I'm a radical reformer. And it was that 2 years that embedded me in this mode for this lifetime.
Right.
Was my 2 years in Vietnam as an IVS volunteer. And I went from somebody who was kind of inclined toward counterinsurgency warfare and toward spreading the American way of life throughout the world as something that's good to do, that's good for people, into somebody, when I got off the plane and finally made it back, I came into Portland, Oregon, I would get these repeated images of a B-52 strike running up Wall Street, just bombing. And during that time, Freddie Branfman wrote a book he called it The Era of the Blue Machine. And that was actually the image I had of what I was dealing with. That there was this gigantic, horrifying machine that was all-destroying, all-consuming, and that it was my mission to join with anybody I could find to destroy this thing, to subvert it, to finish it off. The military, industrial, corporate, American, Pentagon complex. And so, to me, the whole IVS thing, it starts out with the missionary idea, which is a Christian idea, which I was raised in. My relatives are missionaries and so on. You go out and convert them or kill them. We didn't hear about that, you know, or kill them. That was actually what the Pope directed as far as the natives in the New World. He said, convert them or kill them. But you go out and convert them for their own good, and then it's for their own good, you know. They see Jesus and they're saved. We all go to heaven and we live better. And so this became transformed to, you know, like we bring them democracy, we bring them development. And we help them that way. Let's go into their villages and we'll, this is the IVS idea, you know, we'll take the resources at hand, we'll use the natural superiority that we have because we're from an advanced culture, which the IVS has gotten past this already. Lewis was telling me, he said, you guys wouldn't qualify anymore, you know, we wouldn't send you. Mm-hmm. And last time I saw him. And then this became, it went to its full absurdity in Vietnam. It's like, look, you don't like our way of life? Like that, you know, just mow them down kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's and so it to me, it just shattered that whole missionary idea that we have this mission to go around. And so as far as the IVS mission, that's what kind of happened to my thinking about it. I saw it as a part of this whole continuum that leads to the 101st Airborne coming in and just destroying everything. And so I came back, and this was certainly not the universal experience of people. Some people I saw change the other way. They would go over as pacifists and come back as counterinsurgents.
Do you know anybody specifically who did that?
Not to talk about, no.
No. Well, I wish we could go beyond that point and get. There were people who went to Vietnam who were not in favor of what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam, and they came back more in favor of it.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't we want to know who that was? I mean, that's not an indictment. Why wouldn't they? GIs came back from Vietnam feeling that the war was being lost for no good reason, and we don't. See, the problem is that what I find is that we have yet to interview anyone who has anything like that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't find them and interview them, we have only, you know, it's like a self-selective process. We don't know who they are. And if they're at all reluctant to talk, that's okay. We won't talk to them. But it'd be a shame. I mean, I talked to Galen Beery. I mean, but Galen said everything we did in IVS was, look, you either help these people locally, and that gets subsumed into some USAID program, which is called nation building rather than counterinsurgency. That's a part of counterinsurgency. Or you leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we like doing things for these people. We love these people. And if we can help them in some minor way, it was worth doing, even if it was going to be maybe some potential advantage politically or somebody else at some great remove. We didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Now, later, they care. I mean, later, they wish that there had been a better separation with USAID. They wish, some of them wish they'd never gone there. That some of them wish that their development projects didn't really help. But it did build bonds between cultures, and it changed their lives. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they don't regret it. But the point is that there's this dialogue within all the IVSers that we interview. Not one dialogue thus far has led to, gee, my service there made me be more anti-communist than ever. And if we don't find those people, and you refer to them in your article, you know, without naming them, you say, you know, not just Bible thumping, but, you know, people who really wanted to help USAID in Laos and win the war. But we're not reaching any of those people.
Yeah, I know. I wonder
but
why.
But what's wrong with those? Well, the problem is, well, it may be just me, that as people live in California, you know, in Oregon, you know, that this is a different part of the world where, you know, being red isn't so bad, I guess. But my point is that there's nothing embarrassing, shameful, or wrong about having those views, not from our perspective. We just got to make sure they're included. So when you say, well, I don't want to say who they are, it's like saying, I want to protect them because they'll be singled out for some kind of opprobrium. That's not part of our study. That's a legitimate reaction to have coming back from Vietnam. Half my friends came back from Vietnam feeling like they wanted to kill America because it wouldn't win the war, and the other half of them said, my God, we never should have been there. They've turned me into a murderer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like both those people.
Okay? Yeah.
And I'd like to be able to meet some IVSers who came back feeling that, you know, the communists, the wrong guys won, and thus far not one of them has said that. They've all said, look, we learned the history of Vietnam when we were there. It was obvious that the enemy had a sincerity and a root in history that we would never be able to match. And what happened just happened. It played itself out. And no one has said, you know, gee whiz, if we'd only sent in more B-52s earlier, which is what all the soldiers said, you know, we could have won. And I'd like to talk to those people. So as we go on to this, think about that for a while we continue on. Because you're not... you're not exposing anybody. We just need to identify the people so that we can make sure that those people are offered a chance to be included. That's all. It's not a witch hunt, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked to Galen. I mean, Galen and Howard Lewin worked for USAID for 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that all their work that led them to that maybe conclusion was with USAID. Mm-hmm. With IVS, they said, look, you know, this is 63, 64, 66 even in Los Angeles. There was no big war. They just went out there, they did this stuff. And then with USAID, they took on a different persona, perhaps. You could argue they didn't, I don't think, but they could. But not with IVS. Whereas, obviously, there were IVSers that were very pro-war. And it would be a shame if we can't make sure that we see them. I'll give you an example. Let's say a lot of pro-war IVSers live in Idaho. Okay? We're not going to go to Idaho to interview anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But if we knew that we hadn't interviewed any pro-war IVSers, we would go to Idaho to talk to them. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if they returned their forms and said they wanted to be interviewed. We're not mm-hmm. talking about approaching people who don't want to be interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
They've already made their names known. We know who they are. If they're on that list, we're not contacting them. See what I'm saying? In other words,
yeah.
If you give me the name of someone who you say felt that way, unless they've already responded to the survey saying they want to participate, we're not going to contact them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, kick that around, because I felt that way when I was talking to a couple of people, that they felt they wanted to shield, you know, the privacy of these people, whereas the result of that may be that we may miss them because we can't reach them geographically. But it's very important to get those people into the study. I'd fly to Texas to talk to poor people like that if they lived in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. But if I didn't know and we don't see them, hey, maybe Paul's finding plenty of them on the East Coast. It's just that my experience on the left coast, you know, that's what this is called, you know, has been very limited. And you know, professionally, you know, I've made a point. Who was it who said that? I don't know.
What?
Said something like, you know, a couple of the Vietnamese leaders have said, you're the only person who actually cares about finding out what things really were about. That is, I'm not bringing, I have very powerful political agendas of my own, but they're for me. They're not for the work I do. I don't think there's any point. Now, when you come up writing the thing up, you can make a lot of points, but my point for my students is to show them the complexity of the war, because then they can learn something for themselves. If I tell them what the war was about, right, I don't get anywhere. No one is ever convinced by someone saying, you know what you should think? You should think this. Nothing. You know, but the Vietnam War is such a wonderfully complex thing. And one of my students said, you make it sound so simple. And I said, what, complexities? And they said, yeah. And I said, that's because life is complex. The most simple thing in life is like photosynthesis. It doesn't get more complex than that.
Mm-hmm.
Not according to Taoism either. That everything in the universe is in a blade of grass. And our problem is students don't see that. They see grass as being simple. And they see wars and political parties as being simple, and laws as being simple, and they're not. Everything Bill Clinton does is layers upon layers of layers, and everything Bob Dole says is layers upon layers and layers. And there isn't, unless you're prepared to examine all those layers, you take things on their face value. So it's important for this study that all the layers are there, and no one's gonna get nailed. And what I love is that Fred, who was, you know, Mr. Political Gadfly, you know, and pain in the butt for IVS in Laos, and Howard Lewin, who was like Mr. USAID, opposite perspectives, Fred said, you know, he'd be happy to talk to those people now. He doesn't, you know, have any personal animosity. And Howard said, when I interviewed him, he said, you know, Fred was an idealist, and he came to Laos, and all his ideals were destroyed. I can understand that now. Then I didn't understand it. Then, you know, he was just a pain in the butt. And I was really mean to pains in the butt, so to speak. And I'm paraphrasing here, even if he's there. But he said, I understand why Fred's upset, why it means something to him more than it does to me. And I'd like to get that. If I have an agenda, I'm more interested in that. Because it shows the complexity, things change over time. But anyway, enough about what we'd like you to do. How did you feel when you actually left? You know, you expressed, you know, what it was like coming back. How did it feel as that tour as an IVS volunteer was coming to an end? Did it come to an end as a natural progression? You stayed on to finish your 2 years?
Or? That's right, yeah. I finished my 2 years and split. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did you feel about leaving the people that you were working with?
Yeah, the last couple of weeks were pretty intense. Well, it included, like I said, this mortar attack the last night that I've forgotten. Chet Richardson, he offered me any district in the province as a prov rep for USAID, and I declined that offer. And then the head of the CIA mission, he offered me a job in the CIA.
Do you remember who that was? Yeah. No, this is not a name. I mean, we know who these guys are.
And oh, yeah.
They've all written memoirs.
Oh, yeah.
But
I think Bill Colby or somebody
like
that.
Somebody like
that? Yeah, right. Yeah. Bill somebody.
It was Bill somebody?
Yeah, right. Okay. Bill me in the morning, something like that.
No.
Yeah.
No, I knew Bill. I knew Bill Colby.
Yeah.
I saw him before he died. As a historical resource, he was unbelievable. So, you know, like a suckerfish, like a remora. You know what remora are? Well, you're kind of like that when you're around someone like Colby or Westmore.
But
yes.
But it was. I had the funny. That was to me the most. That was something that keeps coming back to me because it. We both thought each other was nuts. That was the thing, and that kept coming back to me. The head of the CIA operation, he offered me a job, and
doing what? Do you remember, or was just join the CIA?
Just join the CIA. Actually, they wanted to kill me. I would have been dead within 2 or 3 weeks because they had these guys who I'd been at a party with, and I told them I hate fucking spies. Mm-hmm. They'd gone around, they'd punched out my buddy, mm-hmm. and they were going to. If I had taken that job, no interview. You know, so that isn't exactly the way
well,
I was.
You would have been running those guys instead of them killing you.
Well, they had a 55-man killer team under their command. They were from other countries. Mm-hmm. The head of it was Australian. Mm-hmm. And they were just going to find a way to, you know. And so it would have been a lot easier if I'd been, like, working for the agency and stuff.
Are you talking about Ted Sarong?
Ted Sarong?
Yeah, he's not.
What Sarong with Ted, man?
That's not his real name.
No, the country was full of these 55 men. They're called PRUs, Provincial Reconnaissance Units, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then, but then the CIA guy who was the head of the province, he had a whole bunch of other operations.
That's
he
right.
had a bunch of third-rate Ivy League guys with white and blue helicopters running around saying, "Hi, I'm from the CIA, tell me your secrets," kind of thing, you know. And
did anyone ever, I mean, other than casually, I mean, did you find yourself being casually pumped for information by USAID?
You're pumping me for information heavy duty.
Oh,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, you know.
Yeah, but I know all this stuff. I mean,
yeah.
I've been through this 100 times.
Oh, yeah, well.
Before this.
Well, that was the problem I got into with them, because they wanted to organize my Montagnards as part of their mm-hmm. operation. Mm-hmm. Their headquarters of the PRU was right next to the refugee camp. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, get the hell away from these people, leave them alone. Mm-hmm. And I'm not gonna do it for you. Mm-hmm. Like, I was the only guy in the country who knew that language, see? Right. That was basically their angle on me. Uh-huh. They wanted somebody who they could, because their trip was to arm everybody. And so that was why the guy offered me the job, and I said, "Look, you're nuts," because I knew the Montagnards by then pretty well. They had their own independence movement. It was called Full Row. And they had just given me like a few like tips of the iceberg about this thing that they had going. They were getting all kinds of weaponry and everything from the CIA with the idea of setting up something independent from the Vietnamese people, who was their traditional enemy. And the CIA was happily going. In fact, they do this all over the world. They'll find some tin pot guy who's, you know, tough and everything. They arm him and so on. You can read the daily news. This is happening everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's just, it expands their whole bureaucratic world by doing this. They just arm everybody, and if they end up fighting each other, so much the better. You know, it all gets bigger. You have more bureaucracy and more And so I said, look, you guys are arming everybody in this war. You're arming all the sides. You're nuts. You're crazy. I'm not going to work for this. It's crazy. And so the guy who was trying to hire me, he says, look, I'm looking at you. You don't have any career. You have no career. You go from here to nowhere. Where are you going? You're crazy. See that? So to each other, we were crazy. Right. He's offering me a career.
Of being crazy.
I'm working for this thing, you know.
For us, yes.
Yeah. And I'm saying that he's crazy, and he's saying, well, I'm crazy. So.
We're both crazy.
Yeah.
And if you live, you'll be played by Nick Nolte in a movie, if you remember that. Yeah,
correct. Yeah. What if I die?
They could still make a movie, but it wouldn't sell much because they change it and make a happy ending like The Scarlet Letter.
Oh, okay, good. by the time I left, actually, Smitty, I heard he was killed later, see, but hearsay anyway, he was a big, I remember the names of the guys who ran the PRU, and the big guy was a football jock, killer kind of guy, he was Smitty. He was at the kind of the ticket station where we got our tickets out of the country, and that was spooky. I mean, every time I saw him, I thought, oh, this is it, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way to...
stay alive.
Yeah. And so...
But he gave you your ticket anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I insulted him only about maybe a week or two before I left. Mm-hmm. Then there's the mortar attack. The Vietnamese government wants to give us medals. And we don't want the medals. We just want to get out of the country. Mm-hmm. And then my buddy goes one way, and I get on the plane, and I fly from Saigon to Phnom Penh, Cambodia, about a 20-minute flight into another world. It was just before Cambodia went to hell. It was still like this quiet little French colonial scene, you know. Yeah, the girl in the bar says, take me to Saigon. I said, Saigon will come to you, you know. And it did, man. And it was just...
Your father is a wise man, wise beyond his age. Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm. But at that time, I was just drunk and shell shocked, and I didn't know it. I was just kind of, right. I kind of staggered around in Laos, and then I hung out with some Laos volunteers for a while. Mm-hmm. And I love these guys, you know.
Do you remember who they were?
Uh-uh.
Well, it's because we could always ask them how you looked to them when you showed up.
One of them was killed a little bit later, I remember that. Fred? Edwards something. Oh, okay. Edwards, I think, maybe. Okay. But I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But Freddie was my best buddy there. Fred Brantman, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this was before...
Right.
Yeah, this was in 69.
Right.
This was actually before he became the hottest radical in Laos. Mm-hmm. He was sitting around, and he was saying, oh, this is great, John. I'm not going back. I like these quiet little backwater French colonies, and I'm just going to hang out in these places forever. I'm just having a grand old time. And that was Freddie at that time. Mm-hmm. That was before he became aware of that whole plane of jars thing that was happening. Mm-hmm. And he just went ballistic, you know, went hot.
But he cut himself out of his own space. I mean, the real stuff in Laos that he could see was so crazy. And he cut himself his own little space. And he was doing rather wonderful in that little space.
Oh, it was awesome, man. He exposed that whole thing, man. He just grabbed those journalists as they got off the plane. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, he was my friend, like, in our training group. You know, he was in my group. So, but I haven't kept social relations with him for maybe 20 years or whatever it is, you know, quite a while. We did some anti-war things together, and then we just kind of, like, drifted apart. And... then I got back to, then I just had a little bit of money left, and I got a ticket home from Bangkok. Mm-hmm. Then as soon as I got home, I wrote this memoir. I stayed at my parents' place around there. Then I got into the environmental movement. It was 1970. The ecology movement was just being born. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this book, and I started writing Ecocide in Indochina kind of articles, and they fly all over the world right away. It's big. Anti-war movement, I'd write something, and pretty soon a guy would be reading it on a plane going to Holland or something. Mm-hmm. And I just threw in totally with the anti-war movement. Is what happened mm-hmm. with me.
And why ecology?
Because my buddy Penfield Jansen was into it, an old boyhood friend. Mm-hmm. The ecology movement was born in 1970 in San Francisco. That's where the whole thing, it went from being a conservation movement to an ecology movement. And there's a big difference, still is. Mm-hmm. And so I had a buddy who was really in the thick of this, and so suddenly, like I used to joke, but it's really true, I would have thought ecology was a skin disease, you know, at that time. I just didn't know what it was. But then I knew all this stuff about Vietnam, and then I was into the ecology movement, mm-hmm. so it kind of came together. That's what all...
Kind of natural.
Yeah, suddenly I was editing Clear Creek. I was features editor of a ecology magazine, being a writer, mm-hmm. and submitted this outline for a book to Penguin Books, mm-hmm. and they bought it, and I wrote it. And it was a hot topic at that time. The ecology movement was big. Mm-hmm. Indochina was being destroyed from different points of view. And I did have first-hand knowledge of it, plus I was really fired up on the topic. I wanted to stop that war. Mm-hmm. It was just, my whole life I would consider to be worth it if I stopped that war by about 1 second. Mm-hmm. Because it was just so horrifying that I knew that the first thing to do is to get the Americans out of it and then let them die. And send it off. I gotta get it Xeroxed anyway. Okay. I think it's in here maybe or maybe yeah. It's in that
yeah.
Wicker basket.
I'm gonna look. I know where it is. It's not buried or anything. I just saw it upstairs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See if you can find it.
Yeah. So you threw in your lock with the anti-war movement.
I did. Yes.
Nice to have you aboard. The what happened? How did you feel in '75 when the war came to an end?
I was completely burned by then. I was frazzed. Let's see, I've been doing radical political action for about 30 years now. My experience with the anti-war movement was I jumped into it, I wrote this thing, and I became kind of like a speaker. That was my axe, you know. Ecology of Devastation, Indochina. Then I'd start giving groups speaking engagements. And I started to find that the major national anti-war groups were controlled by two competing communist front groups, the Stalinists and the Trotskyites. Mm-hmm. And they would always screw with each other's operation. If I was giving a speech for one, the other one would call me and say, hey, did you know that they're a bunch of Trotskyites or whatever, you know? It was shot through with agents provocateurs. It was shot through with agents of the government. And in order to operate at all, people who were actually devoted to ending the war, they were gradually gravitating toward the North Vietnamese party line, was my analysis. Mm-hmm. See, this the anti-war movement is also something like this elephant the blind people mm-hmm. are examining. Mm-hmm. You'll get different angles on it. Mm-hmm. My angle was that these people I was working with, they were, you know, either part of this these front groups or working along with them, or else they were gradually moving toward, you know, like, support the 6 points. Support the 6 points, which is put out by, or 7 points, or whatever it is, put out by the North Vietnamese. And they'd actually go to Hanoi, and they'd get the Hanoi party line, and they would come back. And I never was able to favor the communists. I never was. it was partly because I had spent a couple of years with people who were fighting against the communists, and partly because that, to me, that wasn't the thing. That wasn't it at all. The thing was that Americans should get out. So after the 72 UN conference on the human environment, which had its own radical insanity from my point of view, I was just recently married. My wife and I took it around the world trip, and I just kind of was, by 75, I didn't even know the war was ending, kind of thing. I was out of it. I was out of the whole Vietnam War and anti-war thing. I was kind of more evolving toward what I am now, which is a cottage industry seaweed harvester, backwoods guy right now. And I stayed radical, but I went in, I saw that by the mid-70s, the whole anti-war movement had ravaged itself completely. It was kind of on the ropes. And where I was at, the people who put it back together were the Quakers and the Catholic Workers' Party. They went and organized us remnants, and they started teaching us nonviolent direct action and the nonviolence code, affinity group organization, so that we could deal with the problems of infiltration, provocateurs, and still go on and do major demonstration kind of activity. And so I actually threw in with the people in San Francisco around the American Friends Service Committee, a man who has a name, David Hartsough, H-A-R-T-S-O-U-G-H. He brought this kind of training from Philadelphia, and he changed the entire protest movement in California. Came out of that. We've learned how to follow the nonviolence code, form affinity groups, and then I came up here and I started organizing blockades of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Then we started organizing blockades of the Livermore weapons lab using these techniques. And then Earth First started protesting the logging. And they got all screwed up around the problems of advocating sabotage. It got them into the same shit that the anti-war movement was in the early 70s. And so I didn't myself, but some other people went into Earth First, and they also taught them the whole affinity group and nonviolence thing. They're still kind of like tainted by their ecotage origins, but they recognize now where that leads. Where it leads to provocateurs, to people focusing on the violence, or being blown up in cars, and that kind of thing. And so they follow the nonviolence code, the affinity group kind of thing too. So that's kind of like post-war rap, right?
What led you into seaweed?
Seaweed, yeah, that was just really intuitive. That's actually the most similar thing to the reason I went to Vietnam is how I got in seaweed. It's like, that's why I'm here, seaweed, boom, this kind of thing, you know. Like, go to Vietnam, so you know, like, drop out of Stanford Law School, forget it, you can't, you know, you don't want to be some millionaire sitting there at your desk. Go to Vietnam. And then seaweed was the same way. It's like, go into seaweed. And so I've been in it for 16 years. This is our 16th harvest season. Edible seaweed. It's kind of a health trip. In a way, by the time I got into it in mid-30s, I was at a dead end physically. I'd been drinking, smoking, eating bad food. And physically, I was just at a point where I had to change radically in order to continue living. And so that's the whole seaweed business is part of that. It's a physical backpacking business. The seaweed itself is a healing substance. Going to do nutritional change, diet change, living out here in the woods. And so I'm still alive and running my rap. Unlike several of my comrades who've been it along the way. I may only have 10 more seconds, but, you know, get it on tape.
Yeah, well, it's running. And, well, just for the fun of it, let me ask you a couple of questions that are related to the article that you wrote, so I can clarify this, so when I go back and I'm running over it. But I think we've hit most of the points in the article that I wanted to ask you about.
I haven't read that thing for years.
I know, good. That's why this is the fun part. You know, I expect this to be fun. I'm not going sentence by sentence in this. There's just some ideas I just want to bounce off you.
Uh-huh.
And then you'll go, did I write that? And it just doesn't make it much difference. But I thought it'd be fun. So if you take a look at what we've done and you say, well, you know, I agree with that, we can understand why and work it in. Because the idea would be to be comprehensive, not exclusive, but inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that by the end of 1960 was a watershed for IVS Laos. IVS could have abandoned Laos for more peaceful climes or continued to work as missionaries for development in support of one side in a shooting war. But there was no agonizing reappraisal at the time. They plunged energetically into the task of studying what they saw as red tide threatening Laos. But in 1960, the IVSers who were there just were doing their work. And they wouldn't have conceived that they were actually halting the red tide unless there's some people in IVS who said that. But you don't have any support for that.
No.
And I'd love to find some. And so if you think of some, let me know. Because from what I talked to Galen, of course, there are not a lot of people around left from the original people who went in 1960. That's very, you know, who went to Laos. But the point was that Laos was a neutral country. And therefore, the idea of stemming a red tide, the Pathet Lao, a lot of those early years from 60 to, you know, from 63 to 63, yeah, the Pathet Lao seemed to have a different agenda, but there's still only one government in Laos. Right? There are political parties within it that are opposed to each other, sometimes violently, but there isn't a war. And that's why Fred comes in. Fred says, hey, we can't pretend that there's no war here anymore. This is a big war. And that raises all the ante of what's happening in Laos. But before then, most IVSers didn't see themselves, I don't think, as energetically stemming the red tide. So if you think of somebody who thought that way, I'd love to get a hold of it. Then there's this other issue. Some IVSers...
Oh, yeah, let's stop on that.
Stop on that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that statement that I wrote there is bullshit.
Okay.
Yeah. But right. But no. let me go on and... it's journalism as political action. It's journalism as political weapon, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
A guy reads that, and actually, at the time I wrote that, IVS was still in Laos. IVS was still in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnam War was going on, and to me, that was the all. Important thing. I wanted to get them out, and I would say that probably a guy in IVS would read that and he'd have the same reaction as you. So, no, that isn't us. That isn't us. But then he'd have to look at what's going on, what's really going on. I was there in '69, and Chandler Edwards. Okay, but he's dead, so you can't talk to him.
Right.
Yeah. He was one... I would play poker. I was playing poker with a guy, and they were actually pretty well integrated in some forward...
Area program
or something with AID. And the guy had told me that
It was either him or somebody else. I think it was him. He was in his bungalow, and the Pathet Lao came, and they set up outside the front door, and they opened up with automatic weapons. Like that. Then they stopped. And the guy waited like a couple of minutes, and then he ran out the front door. And that's how come he was able to tell me the story. Because they had set up in the back, see, expecting him to run out the back. So that was cool, right? That was cool. Yeah, it was the guy in Laos. And so I was there in Laos, and they were telling me heavy-duty war stories. Right. And that was, I was banging around in 69. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where I was coming from in that kind of thing. I think at that time, IVS was in a it's a denial of reality kind of mode. It's sort of like, oh, we are independent,
yes,
kind of blah, 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 right. But they're actually out there doing what I just accused them of doing, see? Yes. So it's like, huh, you know? And it did, I think that article made a couple of waves in the hierarchy. I really don't know, because that was the end of me in the hierarchy, you know? Like, the phone line's dead. I didn't want to talk to them, they didn't want to talk to me, so we were going different ways. And, but, yeah, I'd say that was bullshit. The guy, actually, after I came back, and before I wrote that thing, IVS had me back at Harper's Ferry. They flew me back, and I participated in a training. And actually, just a couple of months ago, I was in a panel of Vietnam War veterans, you know? They were all different guys. All of them had been military except me. And I realized that the one thing that we had in common were that we were either now or had been extremely enraged about something. The whole thing was a very enraging experience. And so I was back there at Harper's Ferry, and I just painted the most absurd, violent, ugly picture of where these people were going that I could. I just, like I'm doing for you now.
Right. Yeah,
well, you know, there's no...
Sounds like truth to me, though.
You know, there's no, you know, bullshit. I'm just telling them where they're headed. And this served only to titillate them. The people by then who wanted to go...
were all...
That's what they wanted to go to, man. Let's get on.
Yes. They wanted to see the war for themselves.
Yeah, I know.
And they wanted to show that somebody could be good in the face of all this evil. And you told them all this evil so they could go out and be a counterweight.
Yeah, they were into the, you know, like... Yeah, they were leaving something behind that was really boring the hell out of them or something. Or anyway, they were...
No, whatever.
Yeah, they went for it, yeah.
Okay, and this is... I mean, we talked on the phone. I wish... There's no way of recreating what you said, but that this... I want you to I understand that this piece was written as in the context that the point was to end the war. And by showing that IVS was connected to the war, even good things, in other words, were being corrupted by the war, it might end the war sooner. So I understood I understand the nature of this. So this may sound rather anal retentive as we go through this, but it's only so that I can make sure, not that it gets deconstructed, but that some of the things you say I can validate.
Oh, yeah.
You see, as well as discount, but I got to be able to validate it, and I can pursue it so we get the frame of both what was, what should have been, what could have been. We can handle all those perspectives very carefully if we have to. I don't know if we will.
Yeah.
But it's important. It's fun. Besides, it's fun to know, because I'm learning from this. That is, it's a learning process for me, too, so it's fun. Anyway, we read you something else with this word. Some IVS volunteers were part of the Laos Task Force, sharing with USOM, that's USOM, employees, the tasks of developing and propagandizing the Laotians. Now, the issue is propagandizing. See, I can see how an IVS volunteer, by building a water-sealed toilet, is making that Laotian feel that the Royal Laotian government cares about them. I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But the IVSer isn't saying, you should be very grateful for the Lao government, which wishes to serve you.
Yeah, I didn't know that much about Laos. This guy, McCoy, he was writing a book about Laos, and I was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was kind of blowing it out the ass there.
That's cool. No, it's cool. Yeah.
But
it doesn't mean it didn't happen, though.
But
I remember now where I was coming from when I wrote that. It was hanging out with these people up there, and they were telling me that they were part of this thing, you know, out in the villages, this forward thing. And the guy who'd really know would be Freddie, because he was there, you know?
Yeah, but the problem, I don't know, I'll have to go back over the interview with Fred, but I'll ask him about that. In fact, I'll just put it right here. Because...
Yeah, to what extent the IVS operation was integrated into the whole USOM operation there.
They would know better than
you.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and Freddie's got a radical perspective, so, you know, he would know better.
But I think when I talked with Fred, the point was that Fred felt that this is what people were being used for. He wasn't saying this is what they were, what everyone was doing. You know, again, it's hearsay. You know, he said, I know there were a lot of, you know, the older guys who were associated with, you know, agriculture and stuff like that, and they had a much more anti-communist bent. And I said, do you know any? And he said, well, really, they're before my time, or... You see what I'm saying? It's hard to track it down. And because everything was so highly politicized, and because there is an underlying point, that is USAID is using IVS for this purpose.
Yeah,
this
well...
IVS isn't... The IVSers, yeah. Most IVSers are either in denial or they're not aware of it, so it's...
Well, I guess one of the things that's going on, Mark, is that those of us who are anti-war, we now control the RAP, you know? At that time, we didn't control the RAP.
That's right.
The RAP was... It was up for grabs, and it was, you know, 80-20 on the side of the anti-communist guys,
and
they were more popular. But this war has been so rejected by American civilization that, you know, the veterans commit suicide, and they want it to disappear.
Right.
And anybody who was ever for it, you know, like so Bob Strange McNamara, he's going, oh, man, a culprit, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, but the World Bank, motherfucker, you know.
Yes, but by the time he's...
What are you guilty about, you know?
Yes, but the point is that now, now it has been internalized by all these people.
So
there would be a greater effort to turn the clock back.
So what I'm saying is my one off the, you know, horseback theory that I have is why these guys aren't talking to you now is that we control the rap. We've got the rap now.
Oh, no, I understand that. But
and those guys don't want to talk about it.
Exactly.
You know,
I understand that.
They say, you know, we should have torn him a new asshole, you know, and dropped the big one on Hanoi. And no, you know, it's like...
But two things have happened. First,
that's not the party line
but
anymore.
But two things have happened. First, it is the party line now. The American people now think in larger and larger numbers that the war was not a mistake. They all think now that McNamara's a jerk, and they think we could have won. And that's what people think now. Now, of course, in the minds of these IVSers...
Yeah, well, where I live, they don't.
Yeah, exactly. But my point is, in the minds of many of these people, they think the anti-war thing is still holding sway.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what I'm interested in.
So why aren't they talking to you?
That's not the issue.
Oh, you think all IVSers...
No, John, that's not the issue. The issue is that they might talk to us if we went to them. We don't know which ones feel that way, you see.
Well, you're going random, you know, and then the guys...
Hope. Yeah, but, but what the guys if they all live in Texas?
The guys who are talking to you, they're all...
Yeah, but they live in Washington, D.C.
Me and Amiano and Brad.
Yeah, I know, but they live in Amiano. But most... Yeah, but the thing is that those are politicized people.
Uh-huh.
We're not talking rank and file. And if they all live in Nebraska and Texas, we might miss them, you know?
Yeah,
in other
words,
they may be willing to talk, but because we don't know to go after them, you know?
Yeah, well, you can't find out for me.
No,
I don't know nobody in Nebraska and Texas.
Exactly. Well, there you have it.
It's going to help
you. Okay. Okay, one of the tasks assumed by the USOM task force in 1961 was to support efforts made by, and you use the word, you know, I mean, to me the word's Hmong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way I've been trained. The Laotian word for a Hmong, male, is a pejorative word. It means barbarian, kind of. So we don't ever use those words. But anyway, the Hmong military leader, Vang Tao, to organize his tribe into an anti-communist army. That was a task that USOM took on at the direction of the CIA. This army was molded by the personality of the most super extraordinary IVS volunteer of all time, Edgar Pop Buell. But we've agreed, I hope, I mean, I need to figure this out, that Buell did not organize his tribe into an anti-communist army, did not organize the Hmong into an anti-communist army as an IVSer.
Oh, no, neither one of us will ever know that. I mean, you know.
Well, no, Galen, I think.
When you get back over there, like, who are you working for? When are you working for?
No, it's what you're doing.
It becomes kind of like...
Well, an army, organizing an anti-communist army is not an IVS project.
Well, I mean, I think that the distinction that you're really struggling to draw is pure bullshit.
No, I'm not trying to draw
the distinction. You're trying to, these guys are, these guys are the...
No, you're wrong. It sounds that way, and I respect that. But that's actually not what I'm doing.
Yeah, no. I don't know when Pot Buell did what. And in fact, I don't know what he did.
Exactly.
Know?
I know that. And that's
he was an IVS volunteer, because I went and I read some of his reports there in the...
That's right.
And then he went ahead and did what he did.
Yeah.
But it seemed to me, when I was reading it, that it coincided. Like, he was doing the paramilitary stuff while he was a volunteer.
Yeah, and that's what I have to find out.
Well, yeah. That's okay, my memory was...
Right. That he was.
That he was.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly... That's what I have to find out.
That's what I remember.
Mm-hmm. But you're right. In other words, I'm not trying to draw that distinction. I need to draw the distinction first before I draw a conclusion.
Okay, so now I'm going way back in the past. I remember.
Yeah.
I might even have some of that old, in that, like, one of my trunks.
Mm-hmm.
I might have some of that basic material.
Exactly, the resource material that's used to put the article.
Yeah, basically it was a few of Pop Buell's reports.
Right.
You know?
And what we, and absolutely.
And but so what? I mean, okay, yeah. So you want to, so what?
Well, so what is this? That at a certain point, the CIA takes over. In fact, even USAID doesn't like it. The CIA takes over USAID, and the whole war and loss becomes their operation. People in USAID start resigning.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be part of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what place does IBS have in this? Well, they're, for example, a fertile bed to recruit people out of IBS into USAID. And then into CIA operations, okay?
Yeah.
They try to set up forward area teams. Peters comes out and says, stop this. This is not why we're here. Now, does that mean they're not doing it? No, it's a fait accompli. It's already occurred. See, IBS is only, as an institution, discovered what's going on, and now it tries to put a stop to it. You suggest it doesn't entirely stop. I've got to find that out, just as a point of fact. Because, you see, imagine we have this set of memoirs of people speaking.
So is Pop Buell still among us?
No, Pop Buell.
Yeah, right.
But the point is that whether Pop did this as an IBS or USAID is actually easy to find out. That's not a big issue.
Mm.
The question is nation building of itself a political act? And that's something we'll have to decide. In other words, everything you do to build up, let's say, build a toilet for someone, can be seen as counterinsurgency.
Oh, yeah.
There's no question about that.
Oh, yeah. We were distinctly, as soon as anybody got off the plane or even before, they were part of the whole counterinsurgency effort.
From our political point of view, that's absolutely true. From the point of view of the IBSer who's doing it, it may not be true.
The reluctant counterinsurgents.
But
that's the title of the article.
Reluctance means I don't want to do this.
I don't want to be a counterinsurgent. No, I'm just making toilets.
Now, I don't call that reluctance. I'd say that's in denial.
Yeah, right.
That's not reluctant. Is I don't want to carry a gun, but I will. I don't want to shoot people, but I will.
Yeah.
And they're not doing that in large numbers. They're doing something else.
Right. And so I was just slapping them in the face.
I think it was cool.
Face
no, I got them, that.
Know?
And I wanted.
And
to...
pretty soon they were out of there.
Yeah. You know? That's the important thing. I mean, as you said on the phone, the point was to end the war. And
I mean, get real. You know.
Yeah, that's right. And that's.
Listen, community development. That's where you go, and okay.
It's the building block of counterinsurgency.
Yeah.
There's a temple of counterinsurgency or low intensity conflict, and the building blocks are community development. That's what it's all about. There's no question about that. But it's a question of how.
Yeah. So you're wondering what
point of
analysis you're working for and what
See, if I have to create a frame of text which illuminates what IVSers say, right?
Mm-hmm.
That frame has to match or analyze the perspective from which people are talking. From Fred's point of view and from your point of view, it's clear what was going on in Laos and Vietnam with IBS. And those words will appear just that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'll be Howard Lewin or Galen Beery,
yeah,
or these other people. And that will be the perspective that they sought. Whether Paul and I will even bother to make a conclusion or to try to say what was accurate is problematical. I would imagine that we won't.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we're here for. But we've got to provide a context so that Galen Beery's 14 years in Laos doing what he thought was not just the right thing, but the only thing, as opposed to Fred, who thinks that the whole thing was worse than doing nothing.
No kidding.
Those opinions should have a context in which they can be expressed where the reader can see why these two different opinions, where they come from, why they felt that way. One of the answers may be, as you say, deep denial. one of the answers may be, hey, as Howard said, I think he said, hey, come grow up. This is the real world. And in the real world, people need toilets. We built them. Oh, you think that helped the communists? You think that was going to win them over to our side? Don't be naive. We're just doing a job. Life goes on. And, you know, they hit you with that attitude and you go, yeah, but they were killing, you know, 300,000 Lao up there. And that's not what I was doing. There has to be a way of making sense the fact that this is a perspective, you know? That's the way you look at events in the world. And you've got to give credit for it.
There's a whole bunch of these.
What you got there?
Reports on Laos. What are these?
Oh, look, Laos. He's found the Laos file.
He's found the Laos file.
Of all things, my noble research assistant has found it.
Yes, I told you he was 21 years old.
We gotta burn it.
Keep, away. Keep it away from this historian. Okay. Hey, I do have a question for you.
Get it to the goat.
Yeah, I do have a question for this. The rest of these, I understand. Right, you always call
what's,
it an answer.
What's hearts
right
and
here.
Minds or whatever? Winning hearts and minds.
Winning hearts.
Winning hearts and minds.
Oh, here's my specs right
what
in my pocket.
That?
Yeah.
What book is that, Dad?
What you got there, Dad?
I got to eat it and show it that quick.
Yeah. Well, this is the real stuff.
That's cool. But let me ask you these two questions, okay? Like, and then I can get rid of this. So I don't have to look at it anymore.
Yeah, okay.
One IVS volunteer quoted a 1964 article from the Bangkok World written by Martin Stewart Fox to explain his village work to the folks back home. And then you quote this long citation from what this person said. And it was from the Bangkok World. Oh, I see. See, he didn't cite it, so now I've got to...
Oh, God! He found it! What a guy! This is Pop Buell's report!
Yeah, that's right.
It's right here in fucking...
That's right.
Or Springs Road.
That's right. It came all the way here. Pop Buell reaches out from beyond the grave. And Northern Laos.
We've got to destroy this.
Yes, before the evil corrupts us all.
This guy's
good. Yes, exactly.
Take it right to McLean, Virginia.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, they already have it in McLean, Virginia, according to your analysis.
What is winning hearts and minds,
Dad? The idea is that when you can persuade people.
Oh, shit. This is it,
man. Your cause.
This is it.
Then they won't join the enemy and they'll support you. So it's called winning hearts and minds. And in Vietnam, sometimes the argument was that if you grab people by the testicles, their hearts and minds will follow.
So grab them by the balls,
yes.
And their hearts and minds will follow.
Well, what's that?
Oh, God, I've got all these notes here, man. This is my original notes for that article.
Exactly. Well, great, thanks. Thanks very much. How much will it cost to Xerox it? I'll send you a check.
Yeah, look at that. Far fucking out.
I knew you'd have that. So, I mean, after all, the author of
they just let me Xerox all this
stuff. Ecology of devastation in Indochina obviously would have.
I wasn't talking out of my ass. It's all right here.
Uh-huh.
Look at that.
Oh, what? These maps?
Maps. There's maps.
Maps? Wow.
Oh, God. It's all here. Hello from Laos. Yes, Galen Berry. Pop Buell. Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Vietnam Laos, Xmas greetings. Is that who that to?
He just wrote that.
Want to get it?
Want to get it?
Oh,
it's your mom.
Hello? Okay, you can probably speak to my dad. I'm going to go grocery. Wants to make an order.
Oh, yeah. Hi, this is John.
Hi.